information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight we care.
Appear to border
and it shows.
The law.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
This is a test of the Emergency Broadcast Network. In the event of an actual emergency, the attention signal you just heard would be followed by official information, news, or instructions. Oh, no! Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 205 from Media Monarchy. It's February 11th, 2011. My name is James Evan Pilato. I am your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com. This week, EBN, FCC, and nationwide presidential alerts, domain seizure, patriot extensions, arrest threats, mass meetings, and multiple platoons. Speculation, exposés, and a Barnum and Bailey news purge. All that and so much more. Episode 205, February 11th, 2011, MediaMonarchy.com.
Over and over again.
These Are the Times That Rock Men's Souls, going all the way back to 1992. That's Emergency Broadcast Network, Behavior Modification, We Will Rock You, the Crowd Control Mix. And that's the fitting way we're going to begin this episode 205, ladies and gentlemen. It's February 11th, 2011. And my name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups going back since 9/11/05. Media Monarchy has a huge archive of articles, interviews, mixtapes, videos, all kinds of alternative media, independent, non-commercial, corporate free. And we're broadcasting live, as always, from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. And of course, thanks to the list of affiliates who help carry, rebroadcast, syndicate, and spread the word about Media Monarchy. But the big two carry us live, zeropointradio.com, on 92.3 FM and 1670 AM in Casper, Wyoming, and the worldwide home of free speech, revereradio.net. Huge thanks to both of them that have been carrying the show now for so long. Just like Free Radio Olympia, frolympia.org, berkeleyliberationradio.net, onesskyradio.com, Patriot Radio in La Mesa, Texas, Ground Zero Radio in Canton, Georgia, KBOO.info, Radio23.org, and of course, TragedyandHope.com, and even CJSF.ca, playing the audio from New World Next Week, the weekly video series between Media Monarchy and Corbett Report. You can make contact with me any number of ways: Face, Space, Twitter, Tube, Ustream, Blip, Cafe Press, Podomatic, Gmail, Skype, Instant Messenger, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, Archive.org. It's all linked up on the top right of the page. As well, the donate button. Your support helps keep independent alternative media going and growing. So huge thanks to Jeff in Hawaii, Glenn in Penn, and again, Sam in Belgium. Huge thanks to folks like Sam, return donors to Media Monarchy, and all the others that I'm forgetting. Huge thanks to all of you guys. Again, this is how we'll keep things going and growing and getting better and better, hopefully. It's a jam-packed episode. Tons of clips, tons of news to go over. We did also just record a multimedia B-side episode 204 a little bit ago, where we go over all the latest on all the sites in the kingdom of the monarchy, from Holy Hexes and Food World Order and Cyberspace War. And I did cherry pick one big story from each of those that we are going to go over in this big live episode, again, to try and bring attention to our growing kingdom of sites. Again, as we're taking on folks, if you have an area of interest, a little blogging, news savvy, and are passionate about spreading information fear-free, truthfully, nonpartisanly, mediamonarchy@gmail.com. And again, thanks for all the folks that send news tips and all of those things, and I can't reply to all of you, but it is hugely appreciated. Now, of course, as I come to you on this Friday morning, February 11th, 10 after 10, here in 2011, the news heard around the world: Obama officials now welcome Hosni Mubarak's resignation, coming just about an hour and a half ago. Mubarak leaves Egypt in turmoil. Order out of chaos, my friends. That's the game plan, regardless of where it goes down. And it looks like their CIA head, who of course is connected to our CIA, as most intelligence agencies are around the world, hand in glove with our own corrupt rogue intelligence agency. So the power's been handed to Suleiman, the torturer-in-chief, and I imagine this is my own... These are my own thoughts. He'll rule with an iron fist for a little while, but ultimately I think it's going to be El Baradei that the elites are going to put in because he's a shiny, happier face. He'll be the order out of the chaos that we're seeing right now. The other news that we see right now on the top of the breaking news from Reuters, convicted murderer gets 60-year sentence in the Chandra Levy murder case. So much salacious news out there. So, here we are, episode 205, February 11, 2011. My name's James. This is Media Monarchy. Let's do it. From Emergency Management, FCC announces nationwide presidential emergency alerts to be tested. And their website is emergencymgmt.com. The Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, has made it official. It's released an order that requires participants in the Emergency Alert System, EAS, namely broadcasters, cable operators, and certain satellite providers, to participate in the first ever national test of the Emergency Alert System. The test will differ starkly from the monthly EAS test the public knows so well. In this case, the White House will actually activate the test as if the president wanted to take over the airwaves to address the nation. Although EAS-type capabilities have existed since the early 50s, no president has ever used it. Now we're going to find out how well it actually works. The FCC order lays out how the test will be conducted. It will use what many emergency managers know as the EAN code. That's Emergency Alert Notification, the code reserved for the president to activate EAS. The EAN code kicks in the process where the video and audio content will be interrupted by EAS participants monitoring the primary entry point stations that receive the message the White House originates. Stay with me, we'll explain it all. Stations, cable outlets, and some satellite programming providers are to interrupt their content to allow the White House to take over the airwaves. No specific date for the test was set, although as it stands, a two-month notice will be provided. The FCC gave its staff ability to extend the notice period if necessary and to work with stakeholders to determine the right time of day for the test. In a live web broadcast on EAS recently, senior FCC and FEMA officials indicated the test would be conducted in the latter part of 2011. EAS being part of FEMA's Integrated Public Alert and Warning System, IPAWS. So it's an open question about the length of this test message. So we all know the EAS. When you hear it in the middle of the night, it freaks you out. Little predictive programming. We'll duck and cover for you. If you lost it around the primary entry point, I'll try and flesh this out, and we do have clips and tons of links here for you to do more research on this. But I'll try and illustrate it just briefly with a story of my own. Back at WSHC, a non-commercial radio station, I was the music director there for several years back east in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. On the morning of 9/11, I slept in. And when my roommate finally woke me up and told me I had to get up and turn on the news, I turned on the radio. And I turned it to 89.7, my station. And I could immediately tell that that wasn't us. We weren't making that content. What happened in that event, if you're not a primary entry point station, you essentially pull over. Think of it when the ambulance is rolling down the road. You're not an ambulance, you get the hell out of the way. If you're a smaller station, you essentially will turn off your transmitter, making the bandwidth available for the bigger PEP, primary entry point stations, to cover most of the spectrum so that anywhere anybody is, they can tune in and get the emergency notice. The catch here is that so many of these stations have been hardwired. They've already been changed to where you don't have a choice as to whether or not you want to get off the road or not. Your rack is hijacked. It's wired in. It started, I believe, January 1st, 1997, officially. And as the article said, these capabilities have existed since the early 50s, but no president has ever used it. We're going to go over several precedent-setting stories on this episode. FCC announces nationwide presidential emergency alerts, as I'm calling them, to be tested. So let's go to Federal News Radio, who has an interview with the mouthpiece shill for FCC FEMA on this EAS takeover.
Everybody has heard the National Emergency Alert System. Radio and TV stations regularly test it to make sure the public is notified in times of peril. Well, that system is overseen by the FCC. And now the agency wants to upgrade it by having presidential announcements feed into the alert system. It's also looking at how wireless broadband could also enhance EAS. Joining us with details is Lisa Felch. She's the Deputy Chief of the Public Safety and Homeland Security Bureau of the FCC. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Now, tell us about the presidential announcements and how they would be incorporated into EAS. How's that going to work?
Well, first of all, the presidential the use of the EAS by at the president level has actually always been the case. The EAS was actually, its primary goal is to provide the president with a mechanism to communicate with the American public during times of national emergency. It's also used voluntarily by state and local governments to issue alerts when they find that there's an emergency and there's a reason to do so. So basically, what this test is a test of the presidential EAS. Typically, you know, right now, people hear periodically EAS testing. Those are done at the state and local level. They're done on a monthly basis. The idea behind this test is it would be issued by FEMA, which has the responsibility for issuing the presidential EAS, and it would go through the whole EAS system to the public. It would be done on a nationwide basis. So what the American public would see during this presidential test is something similar to what they see on a monthly basis, the beep, beep, beep. This is a test of the emergency alert system. Only this one would be coming from FEMA as opposed to being done within individual states.
So it's not as if the Oval Office will suddenly appear on everybody's screen should something happen.
Well, I can't get into, at this point, exactly how the test message will be configured, but the idea is that FEMA, which issues a presidential alert, would be issuing this one.
And what's required, technically or policy-wise, to enable this test to happen?
Well, the first thing that was required is that the FCC had to adopt a rule that set the basic framework. Prior to our order that was issued last week, our rules call for monthly and weekly testing, which is done by EAS participants. The monthly test is done at the state level. But there wasn't a rule in place that called for or allowed a test all the way through the system from top to bottom. So that was the first challenge, getting that order out, which laid out the basic framework. The next challenges are going to be working with all the stakeholders, both on the state and local side, as well as the EAS participant side, in terms of resolving any operational issues that might exist, one of which being the timing of the test. Another challenge is going to, and that's going to be a challenge in and of itself, because the FCC, as well as its federal partners, FEMA particularly, we're going to have to coordinate with all these different folks to get prepared for this test. The other challenge is going to be doing some type of outreach to the American public so that when they see this alert, they understand it is a test and not a real emergency.
Why do it this way? Why include the presidential announcements into this alert system? Doesn't the alert system, isn't it satisfactory the way it is now? What do you gain by this?
Well, the gain is the presidential EAS system, the Presidential Emergency Alert System, has never been tested. What's been tested is how it works at individual states. And so it's basically various components of the system are what get tested regularly. There's never been a test from top to bottom where it is issued by FEMA and it goes straight down to all the different levels of EAS to the American public. And so this is a way for us to glean, okay, if there were an actual emergency and the federal government needed to activate the presidential EAS, making sure that it actually works the way it's designed to. And so that's what we get from this. We want to make sure that it works the way it's designed to. If there are things that work well, great. If there are things that don't work well, we can work with our with EAS participants and with state and local governments, as well as our federal partners, to correct or improve what doesn't work. So, I mean, the bottom line is to make sure that this system, if there's ever an emergency where a decision is made to activate it, that it works the way it was intended to. And the current testing that goes on doesn't test from top. They don't test from top to bottom. So this is really the only way to do that.
Lisa Foulkes is the Deputy Chief of Public Safety and Homeland Security Bureau at the FCC.
An emergency action notification is the national activation of the emergency alert system and can only be activated by the president, FEMA, or the Office of Emergency Management. The emergency broadcast system also carried the emergency action notification. It has never been used by any president since its existence. And now they want to test it. You just heard her say we need to test it from top to bottom. We've had the capabilities. The network has been set up. It's all been tested. Obviously, we know radio works, and we know the required weekly tests, and we know the required monthly tests all work, all at stations, all around the country, all the time. But they want to get their hands on it. They want to use it. And even when the newscaster said, you know, it's not like Orwell's going to show up on our telescreens or anything. Well, I can't really talk about that. What I can talk about, shifting the story. So it will appear on all our screens. We mentioned the video. The EAN code kicks in the process where video and audio content will be interrupted by EAS participants monitoring those primary entry point stations, those main stations that will be the feeders to disseminate the official story of whatever's going down when they decide to roll out the massive nationwide presidential emergency alerts. Now, like I said, there is tons of documentation in there. One other clip we'll use to wrap this up is a well-done piece from a longer 13-minute video coming from the InfoWars crew on this EAS takeover.
This is a test of the emergency alert system.
Executive Order 10,995 allows the government to seize and control the communication media.
Our nation is at war against a far-reaching network of violence and hatred. Training camps have been struck, leaders eliminated, plots disrupted. And all those involved in the attempted act of terrorism must know you too will be held to account.
Think about it. 15 years ago, we allowed the federal government to hardwire emergency takeover systems of all major communications and media in the United States. Now the federal government's coming out in the open and admitting what was already in their internal documents, that they're going to begin having federal break-ins over local news.
If this has been an actual alert, this message would contain specific information on the watch or warning being issued.
Well, it's really happening. Bonafide tyranny is coming to our shores. If you look at Egypt, you've witnessed how the government has seized control of the TV and radio stations. But in the United States, the federal government doesn't need to do that. Because under changes in FCC regulations over television and radio in 1996, EAS emergency systems are put in at the radio or TV towers. They're also put in at the national and local cable systems, where the federal government puts a box in at the transmission tower where they can flip a switch and shortwave towers nationwide take over those computers and put out an audio signal of whatever message they want.
Or, as was called in the chat room over on ZeroPointRadio.com, the one-button wonder. And now we've made, of course, the complete conversion to digital television, making it even more of a wonderful one-button wonder. They're practicing it all now, making unprecedented moves with structures that have been set up for a long time. And, of course, we can argue, as we do many, many times, that so many of these structures are outdated and outmoded, and that's why they don't work, because we need to, as Bill Hicks said, evolve ideas. Unprecedented moves. Starting to use and abuse the power that had already been illegally granted upon themselves as these self-appointed, unelected leaders. So I feel what goes along with this well is the one story we'll include here from cyberspacewar.com. DHS seizes more domains, this time for merely linking to copyrighted material. This from Eric Blair, writing for activistpost.com. Apparently, the Department of Homeland Security is now authorized to rewrite and enforce copyright infringement laws. In a stunning precedent, the recent round of domain seizures to shut down websites that allowed illegal streaming of the Super Bowl also included a few other websites that were seized simply for linking to infringing content. Mike Masnick of TechDirt, who received and published a DHS seizure affidavit, had this, among so many other great things, to say in the article. Quote, "The affidavit itself was chock full of legal and technical errors, compounded by assertions as facts that seem to have a little basis in reality. The biggest problem is that Homeland Security seems to suggest, without a hint of doubt, that merely linking to infringing content is criminal copyright infringement." End quote. Additionally, this type of precedent would seem to massively change the internet as we know it. What's next? Seizing websites that link to those affiliate sites like Facebook, Google, or Twitter? That's the exact question that Masnick investigated in the follow-up article he wrote. Homeland Security tries and fails to explain why seized domains are different from Google. Despite Homeland Stupidity's obvious distortion of the law, we are rapidly approaching a day where information can no longer flow freely on the net. We better wake up and share these stories with everyone we know, because tyranny seems to be fast approaching. These words, written above and posted on this page, belong to nobody but the open source, free internet. Share and repost at will. And we will. Links in there to those articles as well, more on just this latest round of domain seizures that seem to hit perhaps a different segment of the population, not necessarily folks getting cracked video games and software, but people who wanted to watch streams of ESPN sports. Go sports ball. And it's all connected. And there's so many things to try and pay attention to. That's why it's so imperative we all work together and not fight amongst each other with infighting in the groups and all those different things that can turn us into all those things that we rail against and hate. So many things to pay attention to. Patriot Act extensions. Down, but not out. From Kenny's Sideshow, the good news is that for the first time in years, an unconstitutional police state law is shot down, at least for the time being. The bad news is that the Patriot Act extension failed because of a procedural move that required a two-thirds majority that fell short, with 277 voting yes and 148 voting no, which means that the majority of Congress are still traitors who don't give a flip about our rights and who remain shills for the lies of the war of terror. Some are predicting the bill will return to the House floor for a regular vote that would only require a simple majority to pass. Obama, doing his best W impression, wanted the extension to go through December 2013. A Republican sponsored the extension until December 2011. Most Democrats voted no. All Repugs but 26 voted yes. That's a crazy mix, even for the phony left-right paradigm. So we wondered if they were going to be brought up the very next day. That was going to be yesterday, the 10th. Now it's looking like next week. The latest I have, just a few hours ago from the LA Times, fine-tuning the Patriot Act. Tea Party Republicans have blocked an extension, concerned about personal privacy. Some of their concerns are valid, but the U.S. still needs the law to fight terrorism. An important message was sent Tuesday when the House failed to extend three provisions of the Patriot Act. It's not that the extension won't ultimately be approved. It was brought up Tuesday under special rules requiring a two-thirds majority, but will most likely be approved next week by a simple majority. Much of the opposition to the extension, notably from freshman Republicans associated with the Tea Party movement, signaled a recognition that the law infringes on personal privacy. And then the opinion page on the LA Times goes on to talk about how great the Patriot Act is and how much we need it to keep us safe. We need that temporary security. There are also links in there to check out which shill voted which way. Posted below this, we do have some of our other related police state updates. But let's wrap up these Patriot extensions in a nice little patriotic bow for you.
House Republicans suffered an unexpected defeat Tuesday when the lower chamber failed to pass a temporary extension on three parts of the Patriot Act.
The vote was 277 to 148 in favor of extending the provisions through December, but Republican leadership rushed the bill to the floor in a procedure needing a two-thirds majority, and the vote came up seven short. 26 Republicans joined Democrats blocking the bill.
The three elements in question concern allowing the federal government to conduct court-ordered roving wiretaps, accessing suspects' personal information like their library records, and conduct surveillance on foreign terror suspects not affiliated with any terrorist organization. The defeat has analysts all over the board now, with some attributing it to the Republican freshmen and representatives affiliated with the Tea Party, and others, like the Washington Post Ezra Klein, attribute it to a power struggle between Congress and the White House.
In any period when there's a minority party and that when the White House is not controlled by the same party that controls its chamber, they get much more suspicious executive power. Patriot Act is very non-controversial for Republicans when Bush was doing it. It's much more controversial for them when Obama is doing it, and perhaps it's simply to be expected.
But what about the Tea Party angle here? Salon's Glenn Greenwald says the importance of some representatives' departure from their party should not be overstated, but this fight was just waiting to happen. At some point, the dogmatic emphasis on limited state power, not trusting the federal government, and individual liberties has to conflict with things like oversight-free federal domestic surveillance, limitless government detention powers, and impenetrable secrecy. And on RT's The Big Picture, a guest analyst from the conservative Competitive Enterprise Institute says the evolution just makes sense.
It was all about economic liberty, reducing regulation, things like that from the beginning. But there have always been some signs that the Tea Party did have concerns for civil liberties. The fact that we saw 26 House Republicans defect today is a hopeful sign that perhaps the Tea Party is starting to mature and realize that economic liberty and individual liberty fundamentally go hand in hand.
But a writer for the Washington Post says all the chatter about a Tea Party revolt is bunk. 26 Republicans voted against the extension, but there are 52 members of the Tea Party caucus, and most of them voted for that extension.
See, that's the catch. It doesn't really matter. It's phony left-right paradigm. It's two crooked wings to make this crooked bird fly on. And of course it will fly on. The agenda will move forward. So many of these people are corruptible and blackmailable. At the very least, we know they're posting topless photos of themselves on Craigslist, you know. But it's a charade. And fortunately, that clip does point out, it's like, oh, well, yeah, of course you guys all went along with it when your puppet was in. Now that the other puppet's in, you go, oh, God, we got to give some lip service about not being for this police state law, even though it's going to grease the skids and line my pocket and the revolving door. And as we'll discuss, some of the other people, Congress critters on their way out, they'll, of course, get to turn around and probably get some cushy gig with defense contractors. Snitch state for the war of terror. posted below this Patriot Act extensions, our related police state updates. New border security plan coming soon from the Department of Homeland Stupidity.
Talking about a new plan to deal with security at our border, and apparently a lot of agencies coming together for this. The Department of Homeland Security set to unveil that plan this morning in Tucson, and Ryan O'Donnell live at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. Do we know yet exactly what they're going to unveil, Ryan?
No, not yet, Tara. In fact, Border Patrol hasn't said a whole lot about what this big announcement is going to be here at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, but after doing a little poking around, we did find out they're unveiling a new model for border security. Now, it's something they've been working on for the past couple of years, involving military-type command system that incorporates federal, state, tribal, and local enforcement agencies. Now, all of these groups actually working together to protect the U.S. and Mexico border. Now, this enforcement change is expected to be the way of doing things for the next several years. Now, again, in about a half hour here, we will be escorted onto the base here for this big announcement. And, of course, we'll have all the details about this big announcement coming up in Good Evening, Arizona. Reporting live in Tucson, I'm Ryan O'Donnell, Free TV.
And now, several days later, even as I'm searching while that clip's playing, I don't really see any new plan that has been unveiled. Much like the fanfare around, oh, we're getting rid of the terror color code, but we don't have anything to actually tell you what we're going to replace it with. Not that it should be replaced with anything other than nothing. More Border Patrol agents. Is that what it is? KVOA out of Tucson reporting more Border Patrol agents and customs officers will soon be patrolling the southern Arizona border. But it's those crazy conspiracy theorists talking about a North American Union. Our last note here, posted up under police state updates on this Patriot Act posting, perhaps could have gone many other places, but here's where it landed, so here's where I'll mention it. There's a new TED Talk from Naomi Klein, the author of No Logo and The Shock Doctrine. The headline, along with this, posted by Raw Story, "We Are Addicted to Risk." So as I started to go through the clip and prepare it, I was going to play a clip because I'm sure she was going to have something good to say. It's essentially all about climate change. Are there real environmental problems? Absolutely. The war machine being a really big one. And, of course, the Gulf oil spill and the poisons in the water and the poisons in the food and all of those things. But no, let's pay carbon indulgences to J.P. Morgan and the Rothschild and Al Gore and the rest of them. It's going to be the greatest bubble. And it'll fit the bill, as roundtable groups discussed, as a way to unify humanity. As I said, so many things that we're covering on this episode are precedent-setting, at least on a certain level of moves being made that haven't been done before. Again, not breaking any new ground exactly. They're just dusting off, kicking the tires. Going to test out the nationwide presidential emergency alert systems. Busting out other unprecedented moves, whether it's seizing websites or bank accounts because they say it's associated with terrorist activity, which according to Section 802 of the Patriot Act can be anything. All crime is terror, anything that damages critical infrastructure. And that's why our friends at InfraGuard will be there with their license to kill, so that when it goes down, the middle managers and sycophants who think they're part of the elite will get to kill people while they protect Walmart and a Chase bank branch and other really critical infrastructure pieces. So as I say, so many situations are precedent-setting. So many other things to me seem like a flashback, a bad flashback. And as we began the show so much with great music from Emergency Broadcast Network, one of my favorites, I use their audio and video and pieces all throughout, woven all throughout. It's in the very beginnings and fabrics of Media Monarchy. Emergency Broadcast Network and their album Telecommunication Breakdown. We began that with the song from 92. Fake Left and Fake Right, Clinton and Bush won. Both brought you more war. Both brought you, as they told you, a new world order. So many things seem like a bad flashback. But let's see if we can find some silver linings to mix some metaphors. Bush cancels visit to Switzerland after arrest threat. This from Reuters. Former President George W. Bush has canceled a visit to Switzerland where he was to address a Jewish charity gala due to the risk of legal action against him for alleged torture, rights groups said last Saturday, February 5th. Bush was to be the keynote speaker at Karen Hayson's annual dinner on February 12th. Ooh, that's tomorrow, in Geneva. And I provided the link for you to the Israel First page. But pressure has been building on the Swiss government to arrest him and open a criminal investigation if he enters the Alpine country. Criminal complaints against Bush alleging torture have been lodged in Geneva, court officials say. Human rights groups said they had intended to submit a 2,500-page case against Bush in the Swiss city on Monday for alleged mistreatment of suspected militants at Guantanamo Bay, still open, the U.S. naval base in Cuba, where captives from Afghan, Iraq, and other fronts in the theater of the so-called War of Terror were interned. Remember, we had our own internment camps here in the States for people who had the misfortune of having parents who had sex in a country we happened to not like at the particular time. But so many of these cronies, so many of these criminals, as the heat starts to turn up, and are we shining more light on this because of the psychological operation called WikiLeaks? Perhaps. But there are many war criminals, but we know their names. They have names, they have jobs, they have paper trails, and we follow the money and follow the connections. So whether it's Kissinger or Blair or any of these sort of front men. Again, George Bush doesn't run anything. Barack Obama doesn't run anything. They're the interchangeable front man face to sell you more tyranny, to sell you further devaluation of fill in the blank. But if we can make it to where they can't travel anywhere, recall the young man who confronted David Rockefeller for his eugenics New World Order agenda just a few weeks ago in Spain. Bush cancels visit to Switzerland after threat of arrest.
What is your reaction to the former president canceling his speaking engagement in Geneva?
Well, you know, this is, I think, very much a free speech issue. In the United States, free speech is built into the First Amendment of the Constitution, so I very much respect the right of the Swiss who objected to him coming. And, you know, we're using this opportunity to object to the, many of the policies of the Bush administration. But on the other hand, I'm disappointed that he decided not to come, because I think more dialogue is always better than less. And I think it would have been perhaps better for him to come and be able to defend some of the decisions he made in light of, you know, protecting the United States world from future terrorism and others. You know, I disagree with many of those policies, too. That's why I worked so hard for Barack Obama and John Kerry before him. But I do wish that all of our world leaders, whatever side they're on, have a chance to defend themselves and talk about why they believe their policies made sense.
What was your role in his visit? Did you have a role in any of this?
No, I didn't have any at all. In fact, I think he did it completely extra-governmentally, other than the Secret Service that, you know, will protect him the rest of his life. U.S. Embassy Byrne had no role in it at all.
Okay, so did any Swiss authorities contact you? Because there was this idea that, obviously there were going to be protests, but a number of people wanted an arrest by the Swiss government. Any Swiss authorities talk to you?
The Swiss did not, to the best of my knowledge. They certainly didn't call me. To the best of my knowledge, they didn't talk to folks in my office.
And no one from the State Department contacted you, worried about this at all?
No, they didn't. I worried a little bit about it. And because I thought that would be, you know, we try so hard to reaffirm the partnership and the friendship between Switzerland and the United States, and arresting a former president would probably not have been helpful.
Well, but you know, sir, it's preposterous to think that a former American president would be arrested, isn't it?
Yeah, I didn't really think so. I think that's probably why the Swiss, officials didn't call me, because they didn't think this was a possibility.
Okay, but again, you're...
Yeah, but at the same time, you can't object to the people that call for it, just under a free speech theory.
But you're disappointed by the decision for him to cancel.
Well yeah, because I do think... I mean, I disagreed with my, not every policy ever did, but with an awful lot of the Iraq War and the enhanced interrogation and the like. But I always think that more speech is better than no speech, and that, you know, let him have a chance to come, and if he wants to talk about it in a speech and defend himself, maybe have the opportunity to do that.
Former U.S. President George W. Bush has canceled a visit to Switzerland, citing security concerns. It came after human rights groups threatened protests and called on the Swiss government to detain Bush for authorizing the torture of suspected terrorists. Journalist Afshin Ratanzi believes it's unlikely Bush will be held to account by an international court.
My understanding is the Center for Constitutional Rights has a 2,500-page document they're releasing in the next 24 hours in Geneva. But it's difficult to know where to start with George W. Bush, because it's an entire cadre of people. It's Dick Cheney, it's Donald Rumsfeld, it's Dick Cheney's chief of staff. We now have Rumsfeld's memoirs. This is about illegal wars and so on. But this case, I think, centers around two individuals in particular, one of whom I've met, a cameraman for a Qatari satellite TV channel, who was incarcerated in Guantanamo for years. And we mustn't forget, 48-year-old died a few days ago after being in Guantanamo for 9 years. Also without charge, of course, and tortured. I think international law has proved pretty useless when it comes to torture. Will any of these come to pass, to actually indict all these people, including, of course, Tony Blair here in Britain? Very doubtful, and the Hague won't touch the people that really are responsible for torture on such a major scale, and for training torturers at their School of Americas. And, of course, we must remember that the Obama administration still has Guantanamo open, so people are being tortured to this day.
So many important things that the second part of that clip brought up that the first part of the clip wouldn't touch with a 10-foot First Amendment pole, suggesting that this won't happen merely because he was the president. We can't go there. It almost reminds me of, oh, well, gosh, you know, a third-party candidate could never win. Yes, they could. Just as we can charge these people with names and crimes... with crimes. And it is the whole cadre of them. And they are parading around. And yes, we did have a bit of Ron Paul interruption at the CPAC that's been going on. Not much coverage for you here on this episode of the CPAC conference going on right now. But from one puppet to another, from a puppet from the past to a puppet of the present... Let's not leave out the related Obama-Saya updates. Now, along with the Super Bowl, which we do have a few bit of updates coming up for you later in the show during the news purge, around the same time, two paragons of integrity went head-to-head. Obama-Saya and the amazing Bill O'Reilly, all timed, of course, played on Fox, and... what kind of important things do you think they would discuss?
Who's going to win the game? Come on.
Bill, here's the thing. Once my Bears lost, I don't pick sides.
So you don't care?
Well, no, I do care. I want a great game.
I want a great game. And it is a great game, isn't it? For those involved. for those running away with it. Who's going to win the game? Other related notes around the election selection, bread and circus, which is already well underway here. 85 Americans are already running for president. AllGov.com covering that story and giving you the link to the page that shows all of the legally registered presidential candidates. 85 and counting. Here we are, February 11th, 2011. Meanwhile, in the cesspool of Chicago, Rod Blagojevich, you remember him, disgraced Illinois governor, busted for trying to sell Obama's Senate seat, connected to Resco and the Chicago Climate Exchange and all of the shady surroundings that brought us Barry Satoro. Rod Blagojevich says there is a missing undercover tape which can prove his innocence, and his lawyers have filed a motion in federal court asking the government to produce it. The former governor's lawyers say the tape in question documents a conversation between the one and only Rambo Emanuel and John Harris, who is Blagojevich's chief of staff. The motion says the purported missing call, if exists, would prove that Blagojevich had no intention of selling Barack Obama's vacant Senate seat. To be certain, the evidence of such a phone call is purely circumstantial. In their filing, the attorneys note that a report issued by the Obama transition team found that between the time Mr. Emanuel decided to accept the position of chief of staff in the White House and December 8, 2008, Mr. Emanuel had about four telephone conversations with John Harris, chief of staff to the governor, on the subject of the Senate seat, end quote. They argue that the government has only tendered three of those conversations. The fourth and final phone call is the call that is mysteriously missing, writes defense attorney Lauren Kaysberg. The government never turned over this pivotal recording nor a transcript of this call. Surprise, surprise. We see it again. The pivotal tape, whether it's concerning our own Portland tree bomber, that tape is missing. Whether it's concerning the kid in Baltimore that was patsied by the FBI a couple weeks after that, crucial tape, missing. And for so much more on this Chicago cesspool story, one, I would say go to the two books from Tarpley.net, Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography and Obama, the Postmodern Coup, but also a recent episode from CorbettReport.com, Meet Rahm Emanuel. Meanwhile, California Democratic Representative Jane Harman to resign from the House. Jane Harman, of course, intimately connected to AIPAC and their Israeli lobby shenanigans. We also recall her Wi-Fi was open and sucked up by the Google Street vacuum views. So Jane Harman's going to step down, and of course she'll have some cushy gig waiting if she had been on the seat for Homeland Stupidity, as we're going to hear referenced in a little while. And we close out all our related Obama-saya, Bush puppet, congressional critter updates. GOP Representative Chris Lee resigns after a topless photo he put on Craigslist emerges. And it goes down in a Washington minute. And these are the light and funny things that it's silly and the photo is really goofy looking and you laugh at him and, oh, he's a Republican, ha ha ha. But all of these stories just kind of glimpse and touch the tip of the iceberg of what concerns this sort of massive entrapment blackmail ring that connects to things like the Franklin scandal. And even to things like Elliot Spitzer. I'm not sure if I referenced watching most of the documentary Client 9, The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer, which comes close at certain points to getting at real truths, but doesn't get there. Limited hangout. So back to the precedents. This story goes back to the first week of February, and as I've said, so many things to watch and so many things just to try and keep up on. And again, we're all dependent on each other to share all this information, to try and get knowledge out of all this raw data dumping out all around us. Hillary holds first ever mass meeting of U.S. ambassadors, from Politico. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has called top envoys from U.S. embassies to gather in Washington on Monday, February 1st, for a wide-ranging foreign policy meeting. Ambassadors from almost all 260 U.S. embassies, consulates, and other posts in more than 180 countries are expected to convene at the State Department for what's being billed as the first meeting of its kind. Officials say the meeting will include discussion of foreign policy priorities for 2011, the AP reported, as well as an assessment of the fallout from the release of secret diplomatic cables by WikiLeaks. Clinton will meet individually with diplomats working in unstable countries to get order out of chaos. The ambassadors also heard from Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, on civilian military operations in the 21st century, and also from USAID Chief Raj Shah, speaking on results-based development. New Deputy Secretary for Secretary of State for Management and Budget, Thomas Nides, will discuss the budget for 2011 and beyond. But on that point, one official questioned why every ambassador in the world was required to come back to the States for a group of lectures when this could have been done virtually, noting that almost every ambassador flies business class, so costs could quickly add up. That's for us, though. The diplomatic powwow wrapped up Friday, February 4th, when the ambassadors fly and flew back to their missions. This story had escaped me. Another precedent-setting move, calling back every ambassador around the world back to the State Department for Hillary. So they could talk about WikiLeaks. So they could talk about civilian military operations. And as we've discussed with the emergency alerts, and even with the Patriot Act, these things have already been codified and established. Of course, they're ambassadors, State Department, they would have meetings. They do have meetings. But this pulling of rank, this busting out of unprecedented moves, these are the things that seem to show us something. The moves that are being made. One button wonder indeed. So, included in the links here to the aforementioned Associated Press, we've also got allgov.com, straight from the State Department, state.gov. We can let you Google civilian military operations in the 21st century. But let's take a moment and read about USAID, the United States Agency for International Development. And we can just take it from public conception, Wikipedia. USAID states that U.S. foreign assistance has always been the twofold purpose of furthering America's foreign policy interests in expanding democracy and free markets while improving the lives of citizens in the developing world. However, non-government organization watch groups have noted that as much as 40% of the aid to Afghanistan has found its way back to donor countries through awarding contracts at inflated costs. Although USAID defends itself by stating that contractors are selected by their own proven abilities, watchdog groups, partisan politicians, foreign governments, and corporations contend that the bidding process has at times involved both the financial interest of its current presidential administration and political motivation. An example includes the rebuilding of Iraq during the Bush administration. Some critics say that the government gives aid to reward political and military partners rather than to advance genuine social or humanitarian causes abroad. Another complaint is that foreign aid is used as a political weapon for the U.S. to make other nations do things its way. An example given in 1990 when the Yemeni ambassador to the United Nations, Abdullah Saleh al-Ashtal, voted against a resolution for the U.S.-led coalition to use force against Iraq. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Thomas Pickering walked to the seat of the Yemeni ambassador and retorted, "That was the most expensive no vote you ever cast." Immediately afterwards, USAID ceased operations and funding in Yemen. It's been said that in the 1960s and early 1970s, USAID had maintained a close working relationship with the CIA, and agency officers often operated abroad under USAID cover. The 1960s-era Office of Public Safety, a now-disbanded division of USAID, has been mentioned as an example of this, having served as a front for training foreign police in counterinsurgency methods. In December 2009, Alan Gross, a contractor for USAID, was arrested in Cuba. He and U.S. government officials claim Gross was helping to deliver internet access to the Jewish community on the island. However, the head of the Jewish community in Cuba, Adela Dworen, denies any knowledge of Gross and says that recognized international Jewish organizations have provided them with legal internet connections. Cuban officials have said that Gross remains under investigation on suspicion of espionage and importing prohibited satellite communications equipment to Cuban dissidents. And there's also the pesky note that in Peru, former President Alberto Fujimori pressured 200,000 indigenous people in rural areas into being sterilized. In July 2002, a final report from the health minister proved that between 95 and 2000, 331 plus thousand women and 25 plus thousand men had been sterilized. The program was mainly financed by the USAID and the United Nations Population Fund. Seemingly, no matter what rock we turn over, there's the intelligence connections to eugenics. Before we keep plowing forward on this jam-packed episode 205, we'll take a moment to remind you that you are listening to episode 205 from Media Monarchy. It's February 11th, 2011. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com. Since 9/11/2005, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups, coming to you live, as always, from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org, and a huge thanks to all our affiliates who help spread the Media Monarchy message. And that's ZeroPointRadio.com, RevereRadio.net, FROlympia.org, BerkeleyLiberationRadio.net, OneSkyRadio.com, and all the others. Huge thanks. And we continue. Senior U.S. Marine says multiple platoons headed to Egypt. From BusinessInsider.com, a senior member of the U.S. Marine Corps is telling people multiple platoons are deploying to Egypt, a source tells Business Insider. There's a system within the U.S. Marines that alerts the immediate families of high-ranking Marines when their Marine will soon be deployed to an emergency situation where they will not be able to talk to their spouses or families. That alert just went out, so says the source. The senior Marine told Business Insider that the Pentagon will deploy multiple platoons to Egypt over the next few days and that the official reason will be to assist in the evacuation of U.S. citizens. Source was told that the chances they were going over there went from 70% to 100%. We're keeping these people anonymous because both would get into trouble for sharing this information with the press. Last Friday, February 4th, because this story goes back to early in the week. Friday, February 4th, Pentagon announced it would move, quote, U.S. warships and other military assets to make sure it is prepared in case of evacuation of U.S. citizens from Egypt becomes necessary, that according to the Los Angeles Times. And as I glance now back at the breaking news, we see what had to be known. Egypt's Mubarak resigns after 30-year rule. Meanwhile, senior U.S. Marines say multiple platoons heading to Egypt. We have all our related geopolitical updates posted below this, with a couple beginning from Copycat Effect. for interesting things, and this is why Lauren Coleman does such great work on what is called Twilight Language, the words and the codes and the memes and the semiology. New Egypt. Helpfully, I think, providing photos as a reminder, and I post them up, of what it looks like if you're in Cairo. The pyramids of Giza towering in the background. Another meshing of past and present and now the future. He also has another great piece on Tahrir Square, calling it Egypt's Dealey Plaza, going through all of the structures and obelisks and sacred symbolism. AllGov.com, getting into Mubarak being replaced by Mr. Torture. You recall he made basically the head of the CIA, the new VP, Suleiman, Omar Suleiman, Egypt's torturer-in-chief, threatens to unleash dark bats of the night to terrorize the people. That's a quote. That's a translation. Dark bats of the night to terrorize the people. Perhaps very soon we'll flesh out and go into the background of Suleiman as the Egyptian events unfold, as if they're following a script, right? So, Egypt's Mr. Torture, Omar Suleiman, threatens to unleash dark bats of the night to terrorize the people. Meanwhile, sidebar, back here in the States, in Florida, bats are invading and damaging the Tampa Bay Devil Rays training facility. Israeli spy arrest in Egypt points to high stakes for D.C. and Tel Aviv. IntoTheAmericanDream.com has 10 shocking videos of Egyptian protests that are pretty much too almost graphic to watch. And I provide the link, but provide that warning for you. Egypt, the U.S., and the Israel lobby. That's from counterpunch.org. Meanwhile, elsewhere around the world for a moment, South Sudan voted over 98% to secede. So that goes along with this from MSNBC. Mideast unrest complicates U.S. terror fight. But we'll say it again. Order out of chaos. The story we covered so much last week was giving you the background, and I think it was very useful, not only to myself, but hopefully to you guys out there. Frank Wisner. When this CFR, CIA-connected shill was dispatched to Egypt, you knew something was up, and that's why we spent the time covering it. Frank Wisner, his father, OSS, CIA, Enron, CFR, all of it. But what happens a few days later? February 7th from Politico, the White House said Monday that the former ambassador President Obama sent to Cairo doesn't speak for the administration, even after he carried a message from Obama to Mubarak. The envoy, Frank Wisner, said over the weekend that Mubarak's continued leadership is critical in Egypt and that it's his opportunity to write his own legacy, while the White House has suggested that Mubarak needs to leave power sooner rather than later. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs told reporters on Monday that Wisner is not an employee of the government and that he wasn't speaking for the administration when he made his comments at a conference in Munich. He was, based on his broad experience in Egypt, asked by the State Department, and I would direct you to the State Department, to travel to Cairo and have a specific conversation with President Mubarak, Gibbs said. He did, and reported that back to us. But his views on who should and shouldn't be the head of Egypt don't represent the views of our administration. The views of our administration are those, are that those, are the decisions that will be made by the Egyptians. That's what we like the narrative to be. That's what we'd like the theme to be. As, you know, we can only make suggestions, but it's all just kind of happening and bumbling along. White House pushes Wisner away. So that was from Politico. Fox News says administration drop kicks ambassador for remarks on Mubarak, but essentially echoes the very same sentiment. EuropeNews.dk, also getting into the story that, again, I believe last week we were one of the few outlets to bring this to you, and that would be the connections of the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, established by British intelligence in the 20s, being visited and trained and feted by Bill Ayers, Bernadine Dorn, and Jody Evans of Code Pink, giving them their Day of Rage tactics. Our last posted geopolitical note, Egyptians Tahrir Square celebration turns bitter as Mubarak refuses to leave. This was the flurry, I believe, yesterday or Wednesday that he was going to give a big speech, and everybody anticipated that this was going to be his resignation, but it wasn't, and tensions rose. But now we have here on the morning, February 11th, Mubarak now resigned. Our couple of related war horrors updates. From Danger Room, one in 50 troops in Afghanistan is a robot. Meanwhile, Press TV reporting that France has denied the 2011 Afghan surge. Not a surprise coming from the French, but we would like to see all the other countries follow suit. So as we're looking around the world and we're looking at robots, and we're looking at surges and precedents, we'll get to the one piece that we're pulling from foodworldorder.com to display on this episode 205, asking the question, are worldwide food shortages being caused by investors' speculation? Again, from allgov.com, world food prices have continued to rise over the past 5 years, creating the potential for malnutrition and starvation in the developing world and fomenting political unrest in nations like Egypt. While some economists have blamed the price increases on growing food demand in China, which we've discussed for you in the previous episode, and India, or diversion of crops to ethanol production, other experts say Wall Street is behind the problem, as commodity futures have become a fad investment, like subprime mortgages not so long ago. Prices began going up in 2006, and by the following year, wheat shot up 80%, corn by 90%, and rice by 320%. The surge provoked food riots in more than 30 countries, where a combined 200 million people faced malnutrition and starvation. By the spring of 2008, food prices declined back to their previous levels without clear explanation. Then, prices went up again in 2010 by 25%. Gene Ziegler, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, has blamed man-made actions for the price fluctuations. Others have specifically pointed to Goldman Sachs and other investment firms. Last decade, Goldman began buying up wheat futures until the market experienced demand shock, and investors were able to set prices to their liking. The price manipulations have now begun to affect industrial nations, with the United Kingdom and Europe experiencing food price jumps of 10% a year. Not surprisingly, European officials meeting in Berlin recently warned of threats to food security and the danger of riots in some parts of the world unless governments take action to regulate the trading of food commodities. This is how far we've come. Are worldwide food shortages being caused by investor speculation? We referenced Goldman Sachs in there. We have referenced it further in the past and much more recently, Goldman Sachs' intimate connection to food stamps. Every food stamp you buy and use, and you're helping Goldman Sachs. You're helping the banksters. We're cutting our own throats. So the related clip from this from the Associated Press is where it's going to hit us. Grocery bills on the rise.
The World Food Program says that civil protests like the ones in Egypt over the past couple weeks are partly driven by growing anxiety about access to food and prices. The era of food volatility seems to be rippling across the globe, and on the floor of the CME Group in Chicago, commodities traders are dealing with a continued price rise in products such as grain.
Food prices are escalating at a very large rate. We could see that actually you're going to see a lot of demand come back in.
The increase in those prices have had wide-range impact, and global demand for wheat, sugar, pork, and beef is at unprecedented levels. On this snowy hog farm in northern Illinois, producers are preparing for record high pork prices this summer. More profit on the farm, but clearly the consumers will be paying more at the store, nearly 10% more than last year.
But we're seeing pork prices go up. The producer's getting more, but then that's going to be passed on at the retail level as well.
Here in America's heartland, 2 feet of snow covers these cornfields outside of Chicago. In January, world food prices hit a record high, and the commodity markets are reacting, with prices of wheat surging, oil on the uptick, and your grocery store definitely taking the brunt of it.
Anything with wheat product, the pasta, any, you know, the sugar baking products, milk, eggs, butter, staple type items, those are the items that are getting impacted.
The lag time from the commodities price to the grocery store is sometimes as long as 10 months. Consumers may not feel the strain immediately, but as 2011 progresses, food inflation will hit the wallets of people.
Now, with all of that in mind, ask yourself why recently ravaged Haiti would turn down food. Because it was genetically modified. Because it was part of the eugenics agenda. As dire as things are for them, they aren't stupid. And we note that California throws away enough food to fill, what, 30 Staples centers a year? They want to sell you the idea that we're overpopulated. They want to sell you the idea that we just can't support everyone. That's going to make it easier for us to all tear each other apart. So, slow kill, fast kill, it's all eugenics, and it's all a war on our consciousness. We'll now pull from the last remaining site in the media monarchy kingdom, and that's the newest one, holyhexes.com. And we take a story from BeliefNet that I could see growing, and I wanted to find a story that encapsulated that, and this does it, from BeliefNet. Scientology under attack from journalists, celebrities, and ex-members. Scientology being something we have covered quite frequently in the archives of Media Monarchy. Scientology has come under a lot of fire in the past year, as the St. Petersburg Times, linked for you here, CNN, and other media outlets, helped along by Anonymous, a kind of WikiLeaks of the organization, have investigated shocking allegations of physical, mental, emotional, and financial abuse claims made by former members. Now, there's a stunning cover story in The New Yorker, quite long but worth reading, about Scientology, prompted by the public defection of Oscar winner Paul Haggis from the cult. The story's making global news, as actress and devoted Scientology member Ann Archer claimed in a New Yorker piece. The church is in 165 countries. Rolling Stone magazine republished its 2006 article on Scientology, a reminder that this stuff is not entirely new information. So, the two cents. On the one hand, Scientologists are correct in noting that any young faith tends to be misunderstood and labeled a cult. On the other hand, the cult's convenient emphasis on gradual revelation, you don't get to find out the central teachings until you've invested a fortune in time and money, at which point most people aren't going to cut and run. It's uneducated and isolated workforce. The practice of encouraging members to cut off ties with doubting parents, etc., paints a disturbing picture. To paraphrase Haggis in the New Yorker expose, if only a fraction of these allegations are true, isn't that indefensible? Scientology under massive attack from journalists, celebrities, and ex-members.
Well, let's get to why Paul Haggis not only left Scientology, but he left very angry with Scientology. He wrote a very angry letter to Tommy Davis, who's Scientology's spokesperson. What are some of the things Paul Haggis criticized about Scientology in that letter of departure?
To begin with, his upset with the church had to do with Proposition 8, the 2008 California ballot initiative that would forbid gay marriage. Two of Paul's three daughters are gay, and one of the churches in Scientology in San Diego had affiliated with the forces that were proposing this proposition. They had assigned their names to this proposition, the supporters. And when that came to Paul's attention, he wrote a letter to Tommy asking the church to formally renounce that affiliation with the supporters of Proposition 8 and actually take a stand against it. He thought that the church, should, having made that mistake, should be more forthright and stand against it. And Davis responded that the church didn't engage in those kinds of political activities. It would stir up more trouble if we renounced it. And he thought that if we could just simply issue a statement saying that it had been a mistake, that would leave it, that he would leave it there. But that was not satisfactory to Haggis. And he began an investigation of Scientology, something that he had not done in his nearly 35 years as being a Scientologist. He had never really looked at what people said about Scientology. And in fact, the church discourages that kind of independent inquiry.
There was a meeting that you referred to in your article about Scientology where people from the New Yorker staff met with representatives from Scientology. What was this meeting about?
It was one of the most amazing days of my life. I had been out to Los Angeles to interview Tommy Davis over Memorial Day weekend, and when he finally did come to meet with me, he said that he had decided not to talk to me. So, but I asked him if he would agree at least to, you know, to respond to our fact-checking queries about the church, and he agreed to that. And over a period of time, we sent them 971 fact-checking queries, which alarmed them. And so in September, Tommy Davis and four Scientology lawyers arrive in New York with 47 volumes of supporting material, these binders that stretch 7 linear feet. And we met in a conference room at 10 in the morning with me and two of the checkers and the head of our checking department and our lawyer and my editor and David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, who had just come in to welcome everyone but took a seat and didn't get up till 6 that evening. The whole day was quite fascinating because it was finally my opportunity to interview Tommy Davis and learn about the Church of Scientology. And it was a revelatory meeting in many respects. And the material that he was able to produce in these binders has been very useful to us.
What did you ask him? What's one of your most interesting questions in his responses?
Well, I think probably the most critical response had to do with the founder of the church, L. Ron Hubbard. In some of the material that I had been reading and in some of my interviews, there was a big question about Hubbard's his war record and his medical history. He had said that at the end of World War II, he was blind and a hopeless cripple, and that he had healed himself through these measures that later became the basis of Dianetics, which is the book that he wrote in 1950, out of which Scientology arises. And I had found evidence that Hubbard was never actually injured during the war. And so in one very interesting moment, Davis said, "Of course, if it's true that Mr. Hubbard was never injured during the war, then he never did heal himself using Dianetics principles, then Dianetics is based on a lie, and then Scientology is based on a lie. The truth is that Mr. Hubbard was a war hero." And the way he phrased that, that everything depended on whether Hubbard had sustained these injuries and had healed himself, was like a wager on the table. And so we pressed him for evidence that there had been such injuries and he had been the war hero that he described. And eventually, Davis sent us what is called a notice of separation. It's essentially discharge papers from World War II, which, along with some photographs of all these medals that he had won a Purple Heart with a palm, other commendations from different countries and so on. At the same time, we finally gained access to Hubbard's entire World War II records. And there was no evidence that he had ever been wounded in battle or distinguished himself in any way during the war. So we also found another notice of separation, which was strikingly different from the one that that the church had provided.
Now, that's a rather dry clip, but I suppose I should have expected that from National Petroleum Radio. But the end there is it gets into Hubbard's military fabrications, touches on the area that connects Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard to Aleister Crowley, Jack Parsons, Babylon Working, and the occult. Sinister forces. All the other related updates concerning Scientology under massive attack, that link from NPR, the Church of Scientology, fact-checked. But we also have more Tom Cruise and Scientology under FBI investigation for free labor, which I think is a nice way of putting it that they're trafficking. And then the back and forth begins. Scientology responds to the Paul Haggis interview. Wall Street Journal, John Travolta, the healer, getting into some of these new revelations we're finding in these massive New Yorker articles and interviews. Scientology then fired their second salvo against the New Yorker. That's from The Independent. ScreenJunkies.com note, 9 celebrities who hated Scientology before it was cool. And of course, Trey Parker and Matt Stone and others among them. But lastly, a press release on BusinessWire.com. Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Books to publish the so-called first complete account of Scientology. It's called Inside Scientology, the story of America's most secretive religion. So within the body of that article, when we referenced the recent exposés by St. Petersburg Times and other outlets and the attacks by Anonymous, those are flashback links going back to June of 2009, May of 2007, and February of 2008, all covered on MediaMonarchy.com. The one flashback not included that we put at the bottom of the page is to a story published by Vanity Fair called The Golden Suicides. Beck, Scientology, Conspiracy Theories, and the Mysterious Suicides of a Rising Art Couple. So that's everything from all the other sites and all the other stories and all the other areas that aren't covered right here and right now as we head to the final half hour of this episode 205. We get to the February 10 news purge. It's a Barnum and Bailey world, and indeed it is, and let's set the stage with Ella Fitzgerald and the Ink Spots.
Sailing over a cardboard sea, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Yes, it's only a canvas sky hanging over a muslin tree, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Without your love, it's a honky-tonk parade. Without your love, it's a melody played in a penny arcade. It's a Barnum and Bailey world, just as phony as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
Say it's only a paper moon, sailing over a cardboard sea. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed. face is only a canvas sky. Hanging over a muslin tree. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Without your love,
it's a honky-tonk parade. Without your love,
it's a melody played in a penny arcade.
It's a Barnum and Bailey world, just as phony as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. It's phony, it's plain to see how happy I would be if you believed in me.
Ella Fitzgerald and the Ink Spots, It's Only a Paper Moon. I play that song, one, mainly because I really love it, and two, because I think it offers one of those interesting peers behind the curtain that we see. All the world's a stage. It's as phony as it can be. It's a Barnum and Bailey world, and that's why we call it the News Purge. 9/11 updates. Surprise! Taliban and Al-Qaeda are worlds apart. AllGov.com reporting on the new report coming out of NYU, which we provide the PDF download for you, the report Separating the Taliban from Al-Qaeda, the Core of Success in Afghanistan. However, the most important thing to point out is the flashback to October 14th, 2001 from The Guardian. Bush rejects Taliban offer to hand bin Laden over. President George Bush rejected as non-negotiable an offer by the Taliban to discuss turning over Osama bin Laden if the United States ended the bombing in Afghanistan. Returning to the White House after a weekend at Camp David, the president said the bombing would not stop unless the ruling Taliban turn bin Laden over, turn his cohorts over, turn any hostages they hold over. There's no need to discuss innocence or guilt. We know he's guilty. The Taliban were ready to try and hand over bin Laden if you would just, you know, show us some proof. And we've now entered the year of the 10th anniversary of the catalyzing catastrophic events of September 11th, glibly called my generation's JFK, and it is that because it's the massive psychological operation, a coup, a psychological coup, if you will. And so it reverberates to this day, and we'll close out the 9/11 updates with a note from Big Sister, as opposed to Big Brother, you know. Janet Napolitano warns that the terror threat is the most heightened since 9/11.
Well, thank you, Chairman King, Ranking Member Thompson, members of the committee, for the opportunity to appear before you today to testify on the terrorist threat to the United States and what the Department of Homeland Security and the NCTC are doing to combat it. I also have to echo the thoughts about Representative Harmon. You will be missed. You have been totally dedicated to this effort, and that effort has been producing results in terms of the safety of the American people. And I also have to echo your thoughts about the amount of congressional oversight of this department. We added up the 111th Congress, and our department testified over 285 times. I testified over 20 times myself. I think that was the most of any cabinet official. That, of course, requires a lot of preparation and work. We provided over 3,900 substantive briefings to different committees of the Congress. So, Chairman King, Ranking Member Thompson, you and I have all discussed this, but that amount of oversight does have impact. So I thought I would just mention that. But let me turn now to the subject, and the very important subject of today's hearing. There is no question that we have made many important strides in securing our country from terrorism since 9/11. But the threat continues to evolve, and in some ways the threat today may be at its most heightened state since the attacks nearly 10 years ago. In addition to the core al-Qaeda group, which still represents a threat to the United States despite its diminished capabilities, we now face threats from a number of al-Qaeda associates that share its violent extremist ideology. Among these groups, we are also seeing an increased emphasis on recruiting Americans and Westerners to carry out attacks. These groups are trying to recruit people to carry out attacks who have connections to the West, but who do not have strong ties to terrorist groups that could possibly tip off the intelligence community. They are also encouraging individuals in the West to carry out their own small-scale attacks, which require less of the coordination and planning that could raise red flags and lead to an attack's disruption. This means that the threat has evolved in such a way that we have to add to our traditional counterterrorism strategies, which in the past have looked at the attack as coming from abroad.
Oh, it's going to come from within, the homegrown errorism. And that's where we are in the war of terror. But we're moving quickly here in lightning round through the news purge. BioWars EnviroHealth updates climate scientist sues climate change skeptic for libel. The man being sued is Dr. Tim Ball, who you may know from, among other places, being on Jesse Ventura's Conspiracy Theory, but also a frequent guest on CorbettReport.com. The other note of BioWars and EnviroHealth, Natural News reporting on a study that shows 25% of antidepressants prescribed for no legitimate reason. So, speaking of that, we move to our drug war stories with a piece from the New York Times that when I saw in print, I made the note that I wanted to add it to the site, and it immediately reminded me of what I went to go find and could only find one screen grab of Mickey looking for the snake poison antidote in the drug mart in Natural Born Killers. Pharmacies besieged by addicted thieves. The orange signs posted throughout Chet Hibbard's pharmacy relay a blunt warning. We do not stock OxyContin. He runs the store in Maine, but we jump down and note that more than 1,800 pharmacy robberies have taken place nationally over the last 3 years, typically conducted by young men seeking opioid, painkillers, and other drugs to sell or feed their own addictions. The most common targets are oxycodone, the main ingredient in OxyContin, hydrocodone, the main ingredient in Vicodin, and Xanax. Brazen and desperate robberies from Rockland, Maine to Satellite Beach, Florida to North Highlands, California. Drug thieves going after pharmacies. And why is all this going on? Well, let's get a piece from Raw Story. In what will likely be seen as something of a Freudian slip by the U.S. Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton said in a recent Mexican news interview that the United States cannot legalize drugs as a means of fighting the black market because, quote, there's just too much money in it. On to the econo crash. The Deutsche Börse, that is a stock exchange, and the New York Stock Exchange are in talks for merger, merging our criminal stock markets rigged with all the speculations and all the other words and anagrams, the frenzy. Meanwhile, a jet loaded with millions of dollars worth of gold and cash seized by Congolese authorities linked to a Texas philanthropist named David Dizier. On a good note, activists and communities exposing Walmart's deceptive practices. AllGov.com asking the question, why did Obama choose the outsourcing champion Jeffrey Immelt of GE as his jobs advisor? Because they're overseeing the bankruptcy of America. And we'll do it again. Get a little bit of satire. U.S. takes out debt consolidation loan.
It's the Onion Radio News. The U.S. takes out a debt consolidation loan. This is Doyle Redland reporting. Plagued by late fees, high interest rates, and annoying creditors, the U.S. took out a debt consolidation loan today, combining the nation's $6.1 trillion debt into a single easy monthly payment. Easy Debt spokesman Phil Rizzo.
When you don't know where else to turn, Easy Debt is there to help you get back on your feet.
Opponents of the plan charge that it endangers numerous national assets offered as collateral. Among the valuable properties, Yellowstone National Park, NASA, and the mighty Mississippi River. Doyle Redland for the Onion Radio News, online at theonion.com.
We quickly blast through history mystery. Hitler aide Martin Bormann escaped to Latin America. Surprise, surprise. That report coming from Raw Story, but if you've ever listened to anything Dave Emery of For the Record and Spitfire List have gone over, Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, Operation Paperclip, it's all intimately connected to the beginnings of our own intelligence formations and even the formation of the nation of Israel and all of those sinister forces. Confirmation, FBI was warned the day before the Oklahoma City bombing. That sources back to local Oklahoma City news, and Jesse Trinidad still trying to find out who murdered his brother, and that connects to the Oklahoma City bombing case. Wired Magazine returning to the Octopus Conspiracy, which I believe they covered in their very first issue back in, like, 91, I believe. No, not that far. We'll have to dig it up. One Woman's Search for Her Father's Killer, the Octopus Conspiracy. Danny Casolaro, Inslaw, the State Department, Department of Justice, Software Theft, the Cabazon Indian Reservation, which is where Coachella is. We made reference to that recently. And our last history mystery note, man says ex-CIA agent Posada gave him explosives for hotel bombing. Patsy intelligence-connected bombings from today and in December and November here in Portland to decades past. But I've got a jam-packed list of media and memes, the first of which a great piece from Kenny Sideshow on the criminally infested Super Bowl, so not the least of which he had wanted war criminal George Bush with his lovely wife, vehicular manslaughter Laura Bush, seated at the Super Bowl in their swanky seats, and behind them, between them, above them, is the one and only Ashton Kutcher. And they sort of form a pyramid. And as if to drive it home, there's one more kid above and behind Ashton Kutcher that has a pyramid cheese hat on. You must see the photo posted up here on the News Purge. But blasting down the other media memes and still related to the Super Bowl, underage sex trade booming at the Super Bowl. That's from The Independent. Of course, Aguilera fumbled the anthem. Chrysler's $9 million Super Bowl ad with Eminem was the longest and most expensive Super Bowl ad ever made. But on around the TV fakery, Chinese TV shows clips from Top Gun as a military drill. Tony Scott, military involvement in making Top Gun. Disney looks to the cradle to expand business. That's from the New York Times. AOL and Huffington team up to provide that perfect blend of sanitized news and gossip.
AOL is stepping up its efforts in news and online advertising with a $315 million deal to buy Huffington Post. The acquisition is among the most aggressive moves so far by AOL CEO Tim Armstrong. It's in an effort to reshape the fallen internet icon.
What they get with the Huffington Post is a brand more than anything. They get the Huffington name. And it's a name that says to most people news and current events, which is what you don't think of for the most part when you think of AOL.
AOL will also be adding the Post co-founder Arianna Huffington to its management team. Her expertise has helped the Post grow to one of the top 10 current events and global news sites.
Few other news organizations have been able to reproduce that as quickly. So they get someone who knows how to produce growth, and that's sort of what they're looking for.
After the acquisition closes later this year, Huffington is to run AOL's array of content. It's a growing portfolio and includes popular technology sites Engadget and TechCrunch, local news sites Patch.com, and online
Now, of course, Huffington Post never had any time for any questions concerning 9/11. And we also provide hashtag HuffPuff because Adbusters have noted that the left created Huffington Post and the left can take you down. We'll see if anything comes from that, but we again have Natural News noting that with Huffington Post sold to AOL, naturalnews.com invites alternative health authors to join a truly independent news network. Meanwhile, furthermore, in the media memes, again, so many things to keep track of, so many interesting, large things going on, they pass me by, and I have to go back and pick up the pieces that J.D. Salinger, the enigmatic author of the mysterious Catcher in the Rye, dies at age 91. Tura Satana, star of Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill, and even an Elvis ex-girlfriend, she has died at the age of 72. Kidnap victim John Paul Getty III died at the age of 54. Gary Moore, guitarist for Thin Lizzy, died at age 58. And we close out our media memes with a note of red, white, and blue that the white stripes have broken up. And because I want to, and because I am a fan, and I'm glad now that I saw them two times live on the East Coast a few years ago, we'll do the hat trick. We'll have another musical moment. Little Ghost from the White Stripes.
Little ghost, what I'm scared of most. Can you scare me up a little bit of love? I'm the only one that sees you, and I can't be much to please you. And it's knocking down to meet the Lord above. The first moment that I met her, I did not expect to expect her. When I shook her hand, I really shook her glove. She looked into me so sweetly, and we left the room discreetly. No one else could know the secret of our love. Little ghost, what I'm scared of most. Can you scare me up a little bit of love? I'm the only one that sees you, and I can't do much to please you. And it's not your time to meet the Lord above. Every morning I awoke, I see my little ghost. Wondering if it's big or it's lying there. I lean to touch her and I whisper, but not brave enough to kiss her. When I held her, I was really holding there. Little ghost, what I'm scared of the most. Can you scare me up a little bit of love? I'm the only one that sees you, and I can't do much to please you. And it's not your time to meet the Lord above. Though I tried my best to keep it, there really was no secret. Must have looked like I was dancing with the wall. No one else could see this apparition, but because of my condition, I fell in love with a little ghost, and that was all. Little ghost, what I'm scared of the most. Can you scare me up a little bit of love?
Little Ghost from the White Stripes, because I wanna. But furthermore, blasting through the news purge, it gets darker as we cover our murder and mayhem with an update with a story that we followed all the way back from March of 2009, and that would be the death of William Bennett, CIA contract killers, Kosovo, and questions. The latest in this story, teen pleads guilty in fatal beating of William Bennett. First guilty plea, an attack that killed a Loudoun man and injured his wife. The flashback link is there for you to investigate this bizarre story of the death of William Bennett. Copycat Effect again, getting into the twilight language surrounding Gabrielle Giffords, 1 month to the day of the shooting. She says she wants toast. Lauren Coleman breaks down the association between toast and NASA and what we do when we're cheersing a glass. John Skilling, son of ex-Enron boss Jeffrey Skilling, found dead at the age of 20. Meanwhile, the court appearance has been delayed in the Ohio, Youngstown, Ohio fraternity shooting case.
For joining us on this day following a tragic shooting that claimed the life of a YSU student and wounded 11 other people. Tonight, prosecutors revealed that the two men in custody could face more charges and that Braylon Rogers and Columbus Jones Jr. could possibly face the death penalty if convicted. Also, Ohio Governor John Kasich was on the Youngstown State University campus this afternoon in response to those shootings. The Youngstown detectives are still trying to nail down a motive in Sunday's deadly shooting, and tonight, as several victims recover in the hospital, the two men accused are jailed with no bond. 21 News reporter Michelle Nix joins us from Youngstown Police Headquarters with the latest in this ongoing investigation. Michelle?
Bob, the two Youngstown suspects with no connection to YSU could face even more charges in the shooting rampage near the YSU campus early Sunday morning. And the prosecutor tells me that the suspects, just 19 and 22 years old, could face the ultimate punishment for their alleged crime. As 19-year-old Braylon Rogers sits in jail, he has a tattoo on his chest with the words, "Death before dishonor." A phrase that could haunt him now that he's charged along with Columbus Jones Jr. with killing YSU student Jamail Johnson and shooting and wounding 11 others.
Death before dishonor. As we've covered media, or rather the murder and the mayhem, the mass murder contagion, it gets a little salacious. And unfortunately, I'll cover stories like these just to give you and to try and, as I had it told to me in a way, I try and tell you the story of the week. But I'll apologize in advance for this. Semen in yogurt linked to Albuquerque grocery store worker. But even worse than that, Safeway Pharmacy mistakenly gives a pregnant woman an abortion pill.
Tonight, a mother might lose her unborn child because of a prescription drug mix-up. 7 News reporter Russell Haythorne uncovers how a pharmacy ended up switching an antibiotic with an abortion drug.
This is my first child, so it's really difficult to deal with.
Marina Silva and her boyfriend Chris are off to the doctor for what should be a routine visit, but this is anything but routine.
My baby could have deformities. There's a lot that goes with it.
3 days ago, Marina took a drug she absolutely should not have.
I took it because I thought it was mine.
Marina Silva came to the pharmacy at this Safeway for an antibiotic. What she was given was another woman's prescription for methotrexate. Methotrexate is used in chemotherapy regimens to treat cancer, but it is also used to terminate pregnancies during the early stages. After she took it, Marina started feeling nauseous.
Came back and I looked at the bottle and it wasn't my name.
She called her doctor.
My doctor immediately told me to try and make myself vomit to see if I can get the medicine to come back up.
She was then rushed to Platte Valley Medical Center. They gave her charcoal to absorb the drug, but it may have been too late.
For all this to happen now, it's really overwhelming to know that I have to come home and sit and wait.
When 7 News asked, Safeway admitted its pharmacy mixed up prescriptions. The methotrexate was intended to go to a 59-year-old woman with the exact same last name and a similar first name.
It says she was born in 53.
In a statement to 7 News, Safeway says, "We have extended our sincere apologies to the customer and offered to pay any medical expenses incurred as a result of the prescription error." It goes on to say, "We are very concerned about how this happened, and we are conducting a full and complete investigation to ensure our procedures and policies are being followed." Marina isn't so convinced.
Sorry's not going to cut it. I'm going to have to deal with this for a long time.
In Fort Lupton, Russell Haythorne, 7 News.
Doctors say a number of things could happen in this case. Marina Silva could miscarry. She could carry the child to full term with severe birth defects. Or she could have a happy, healthy baby. 7 News checked, and it is common practice for Walgreens and other pharmacies to ask for your address when issuing prescription medication, just in case the names are similar. And Safeway says it subscribes to the same policy, although it appears that no one asked in this case.
And again, I apologize, but this is how we'll close out the murder and mayhem. New York executive of a Muslim TV station convicted of beheading his wife.
A New York jury has convicted a Muslim man of beheading his wife in 2009. Muzamil Mohassan is the founder of Bridges TV. That's a TV station in Buffalo that was supposed to counter negative stereotypes of Muslims. The Pakistan-born Muslim had been served divorce papers 1 week before police found his wife's body at the TV station. She was stabbed and decapitated, prompting speculation her death was an honor killing.
So now our last two areas, West Virginia worry, but first our Oregon oddities. With a letter posted up on henrymaco.com, Fritz Springmeier writes from prison. If you're not familiar with this story, it's much too convoluted to go into right now. Fritz Springmeier, author of a book and others with names like Bloodlines of the Illuminati, has been put into prison for a long, long time, but it's looking like he may get out soon, and he's in Sheridan, Oregon. So hopefully he will get out, and we'll have an opportunity to speak with him and hopefully tell that story. The other Oregon oddity, Central Oregon airspace considered for drone testing, but private pilots worry. That comes from our own Oregonian. I believe the headline in the print edition was something about Bend pilots want a drone zone. Now, the only drone zone I want is the fantastic commercial-free ambient streaming audio channel from Soma FM. But I digress. West Virginia worry starts off with a good note, with reports from WVGazette.com as well as ABC News. West Virginia residents win first round in chemical case. Judge says Bayer can't produce toxic chemical in West Virginia. We've reported on Bayer and their crop science division and the explosions in West Virginia and abroad. GOP takes aim at Obama agenda backers for 2012. That's from the Washington Times, and they're mainly noting new West Virginia senator, former West Virginia governor Joe Manchin. Strange odor reported by West Virginia and Maryland officials along the state border. That's from the Environmental Examiner out of Charleston. And I guess that sets the stage as we see all these strange kind of biological anomalies or seeming anomalies going on with the mass animal die-offs. Here's one from WHSV.com going right back to the newspaper that we used to deliver, the Register Herald. Right back from where I'm from in southern West Virginia, investigating reports of several dead horses at a Greenbrier farm. And I believe by several, we mean 21. The mass animal die-off story continues as we see all these stories continuing and swirling around so many with speculation. So as we close this episode, I grabbed the most recent update that was up on the top of Google News as of just a few minutes ago, and this kind of sums it up. As we see these stories unfold, and we wonder again, the strings being pulled. Pull back the curtain, the wizard, any analogy you want to use. There's more at work than what we see, and we're only going to learn as time goes by, and we're only going to learn if we talk about it and share information. But I thought this headline from CNN kind of sums this up fairly well. Egyptian president steps down amidst groundbreaking digital revolution. I'm glad to join you on our own groundbreaking digital revolution. Truly independent, non-commercial, non-corporate alternative media. If you find this valuable, please support us, and we'll keep doing it. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been episode 205 from Media Monarchy, February 11, 2011. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, reminding you, as always, don't hate the media, become the media. Take care.
MediaMonarchy.com is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Featuring weekly radio shows on the Portland Radio Authority, PRAradio.org. the World Next Week video series with CorbettReport.com. Plus special interview episodes, B-sides, mixtapes, and so much more. Send news tips to MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. You can make a donation or mail media to The Monarchy at P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon 97212. Thanks to all the internet and community radio stations who broadcast these shows, and most of all, thanks to you. Remember, don't hate the media, become the media.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not go up with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.